What sort of reaction do you get when people discover that you are not an Indian?
Oh, this has been going on for almost 40 years now, so... Well, in India, they discovered it with my second book. With my first book, they said, oh, very good, wonderful. Second book, this foreigner, what does she know about India? And the other way around here, actually, people even who don't know me somehow seem to think that I'm Indian, even before they hear my name, so I don't know why. Maybe I look Indian after all this time. I don't know.
Well, I just made an assumption myself.
Oh, really?
Over
that
a number of years that you were Indian.
Oh, no.
I didn't realize that you were not. So,
no.
But there wasn't any animosity in India towards your work as a result of the fact that you turned out to be a European.
I don't know. I don't think they like you. Well, not really. But I think they would have preferred me to be in.
Be one of their own, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, of course, you grew up in Europe and England, and in reading some of the biographical data, I see you married an Indian architect and went to India. What kind of cultural shock, if any, did you have by going from Europe and living in India?
No, I didn't have any. I had absolutely none whatsoever. I went from England. Well, it was my third country. I mean, I'd gone to England as a refugee, so maybe whatever shocks I'd had, I'd got over with. So by the time I went from England to India, I was, you know, it was just a different environment. I was terribly excited. I thought it was just the most wonderful place I'd ever seen. And I'd been in England, only in wartime England, and just after the war, so it was pretty dreary. And suddenly I came into this great sun-drenched place, and I just thought it was marvelous, wonderful.
What year was that?
1951.
And was it Delhi?
Yes.
What was it like?
What, in 1951?
No, what was Delhi like? What was India like to you as you saw it for the first time?
In 1951, well, of course it was just after independence, so it was a newly born country, really, and it was, well, to me it was physically so exciting because of all these tremendous colors, and this, especially after war, I mean, after Nazi Germany and wartime England, suddenly I came to this great bursting place and full of all that Indian food. I mean, I'd never dreamt of anything like that. I'd been, you know, on rations ever since I was a child. And all those rich foods and those rich colors and the sun shining forever and parrots flying about and all this great lush vegetation. I mean, it was just astonishing. There was no question of a culture shock. That started 10 years later, I think, you know, after I've been there for 10 years.
The cultural shock started 10 years later.
Well, and then it wasn't a cultural shock. Then it was just began to be a cultural disorientation. I felt, I began to sort of long to be back in Europe or to long for certain European things. And I guess I started to feel culturally homesick. Not actually homesick. I didn't really want to go. But there were things I began to miss.
How substantial a European community was there when you lived in...
In India, for the first 10 years, I never spoke to a single European. Never. I never knew any Europeans at all. Later, because I made some friends, mostly among diplomats, because I was in Delhi, diplomats and journalists. But the first 10 years, I mean, I was having children all the time, so I really didn't have time to do anything except, well, I was writing books and having these children. So I couldn't... You know, I really didn't have any much social life except what was around my husband's partly family and partly, you know, business people, colleagues.
Yeah, I can see that maybe after 10 years of this semi-isolation from European companionship that you might develop a degree of cultural disenchantment. if that's the phrase.
Yeah. Well, it became slowly disenchantment, because it was a sort of disorientation, and because I was reading avidly all the time. I mean, I was reading all the European classics over and over and over again for 10 years. And that may have increased it too. I mean, you know, that I was intellectually or mentally living in a completely different world from the one that was around me.
I recently was talking to Gunter Grass, who spent a year or more in Calcutta with his wife. And did you read the book? I can't recall the title. It's a large book which has many watercolors and India ink sketches of what he saw and heard and absorbed during that year in India. At first he was telling me that he had trouble writing about it because it was actually he had to paint it in order to write about it. That was how he was able to put in words his feelings and his shock at the tremendous amount of poverty in Calcutta. Now, to what degree you were isolated from it, I would guess, over a period of time, but did you come to an awareness that there were major problems with regard to poverty and dislocation in India?
Again, slowly. It took me years. I didn't, in the beginning, I mean, I used to see, but I just didn't, I know people go there and just can't stand it. I began not to be able to stand it after 10 years. Suddenly, you know, when it just seemed to have come, when I first saw it, it sort of seemed like biblical to me, you know, real beggars, real lepers, and all that. It was part of the sort of Indian panorama that I was viewing. After 10 years, I realized, you know, I was living on top of all this. I was living at the expense of all this.
Even in heat and dust, the poverty is only in the peripheral of the story, because everybody is the English colony is well-to-do. The prince is obviously fantastically wealthy. So the poverty of India doesn't completely intrude in that story.
No, it wouldn't. I mean, I would only write about sort of the sort of people I know or whom I lived among, and those were not the poor. But on the other hand, an awareness of their presence, and that one is really living at their expense, gradually sort of seeps in and saps whatever contentment there could be in your life. But I would never write about communities I haven't lived among or don't know.
What happened to lead you to make the decision to actually leave India and come? I guess you came. Did you come to America directly?
Yeah, I came to
America. Tell me about what happened there and how you reached that decision.
That was after 24 years. So I was there a very long time. Well, by that time, my children were grown up, and they had left too. And then I won the Booker Prize in England, so I took the money and took an apartment in New York and bought some furniture with it. And that was it, really. That's how I came.
But did you have contacts and friends in New York?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. First of all, they were the people I've been making films with all those years.
The Merchant Ivory.
Yeah.
Team. So they were here.
They were here. They were in New York. And I was with the New Yorker. I had a publisher. I had an agent. I had friends here. Oh, yeah, I had a lot of contacts. I didn't come as a stranger.
That would be frightening for me, and I think for most people, just to pack up and leave and go to a strange place where one didn't know anyone.
Oh, no, I knew more people here than there, and, you know, and closely, very close.
Is that why you came to New York rather than back to England, because you had more contact?
I had more contact, and I also, I felt very much at home in New York whenever I had visited here, I felt it was a more European city than London. I mean, I loved London, but I didn't feel that it was so much my city as this one. I mean, most of the refugees did come here to New York. We went to England because we didn't get a visa at the time. We were waiting for a visa. and it didn't come, and then the war broke out, so we were in England.
Do you still feel the same way about New York as you did when you first arrived, with all of its problems? Probably about poverty.
Well,
I mean,
yeah, well, because those weren't there when I first came. At least they weren't so obvious. Well, I'm still happy living here. But, of course, it's becoming more like India now, so it's not unfamiliar to me either.
It really is. In my 25 years here, I've noticed a substantial change in the city's social structure, and it has not been good.
Yes, oh, yeah.
But it's also... I was talking to P.D. James on Monday, and England is changing, too. England is always a little behind America, but there is an accelerated rate of crime and poverty and unemployment there.
Yeah.
And while it's not as bad, unemployment is bad, but crime is not quite as bad as it is here.
Yeah, but it takes them like 5 years to catch up, usually, on everything.
According to P.D. James, they're starting to catch up.
They've started.
And they've even had something unheard of. Over the last couple of years, they've had a number of mass murders. You know, three or four people killed in a shooting spree, and I mean that was unheard of before, as it was in this country when I was a kid. I mean, if there was a mass murder, or because I grew up in the Midwest, I can't recall ever having a murder near me or around me or anything. It was just a benign existence. And now it seems to be so commonplace, it's frightening. Well, tell me how you were able to reconcile your transcontinental life with being married to your husband, who is an architect. And I noticed he did
the
beautiful
cover,
painting on the cover of your book.
Well, at that time, he still had his office in Delhi, so we used to commute backward and forward quite a bit. He'd come like about four times a year, and I'd go to India about once or twice a year. But now he's retired anyway, so he lives here too, and we just go to India once a year now.
Oh, so he is living in New York now?
No, he's here, mostly, yeah.
Well, that solved the problem.
Yeah, but it took some time. I mean, he only retired like about 2 years ago.
Uh-huh. Where are your children?
Well, because they're all grown up and married. One is in India, one is in England, and one is in California.
Let's talk a little bit about your new book, Poet and Dancer. This is a lovely book about two young women who consider themselves, well, one a poet and the other a dancer, and yet neither of them really becomes that way. Their lives are really not quite fulfilled. Tell me a little bit about the origin of this book and how you conceived of the characters in this story.
Well, the origin of it is really, what happens at the end is something that I'd heard about two girls doing what these two girls do at the end. And that always haunted me, and I always thought, well, how do they get to that point? How did that happen? These two girls alone in an apartment, how did they decide, you know, just to exit, just to quit? How did they get to that point? Two girls who were obviously very close to one another, and I think that's how it sort of started off, the whole thing. Just this, how people can get into such a dead end, such a terrible pass.
Well, let's look at the personalities of Laura and Angel. Laura, of course, is very apparently emotionally disturbed, and this becomes even more apparent as the story unfolds. But Angel, she bothers me in a way, because she seemed as a child to have a great deal of potential to do something, and this was never fulfilled. And her sexuality was interesting. I don't believe she was sexual at all, at least the way you describe her, at least in the way that Laura was. And any sexual fantasies you might have had were aimed at Laura, and even those weren't realized the way you have it depicted, or am I incorrect?
No, you're completely correct. I think of her as asexual, as if for her, her love for the other girl, for her cousin, is something too pure for her to mix up with anything sort of physical. I think Angel, well, this was also really my theme in a way, that I thought that Angel was a poet. I mean, she could have been developed a poet, she would have developed, but she got into this awful kind of obsession with Lara. She just, she gave up her own soul in a way, which meant also, you know, the potential to be a poet or to be certainly something more than she ever became. She gave it up for somebody else.
You have well drawn two families. I mean, it's not just the two girls. Their lives, of course, interact with all the various members of their family, some of whom are themselves a little dysfunctional. But isn't it interesting how you create this world of people? You create a world and you populate it with characters that may or may not come out of your mind. When you create a structure like this, do you say, here is family one and family two, and I'm going to put X number of characters in it, and this father, and that father, and that mother, and that ex-wife? I mean, how does this, how does this unfold exactly?
No, nothing like that happens. I mean, it unfolds with this tiny nucleus of these two girls who become so obsessed and involved with each other. And then, well, of course, they have to grow out of something. They have to grow out of their family relationships. And of course, the only kind of families I know are the ones that, are a bit like my own background. A kind of mixture also of German, Jewish, and a bit of English, and so naturally I place them in that context of a German-Jewish family transplanted to New York, but with links with Europe as well.
And with India.
And with India.
Because there are some Indian characters who play a major role in the story. Yes. And in fact, I thought for a while, Angel might well develop a relationship with the young Indian man who works for the airline, but it never happens.
No, she might have had, but she'd become so obsessed with this one person. She gave up everything. She gave up that boy. She gave up her own mother. She gave up her grandmother. She gave up on everything, and on herself, most of all, of course, just for this obsession with a person who could only bring her harm.
Why do you suppose, and of course even you, I think, have to speak hypothetically in a way, because sometimes I'm not sure the author of a book has all the answers. I was talking to Doris Lessing some time ago, and she was telling me about some of the scholarly articles written about her, critical analyses and this sort of thing, and they were saying, and Doris Lessing intends to do this and intends to do that, and Lessing told me, she said, I didn't intend to do anything. I was just writing a story, you know. And again, they're attributing all these motives to me. But I wanted to ask about Laura's father, the psychiatrist. Here's a man who should have been able to do something for his daughter, but did not, except to prescribe some pills. Why do you suppose he was incapable of dealing with his daughter, at least on a professional, if not on a parental level?
Well, I think he'd sort of given up on his profession. He'd gone into kind of a guruship, you know. He was concerned now with his, not even patients, his disciples, whom he was leading into a new kind of, he called it, you know, really healthy humanity. In the meantime, sort of real-life problems of his own daughter was something he could no longer deal with. He was living in this hypothetical world of his own. This is a theme I've come, you know, I've gone over so many times about somebody setting up as a kind of, as a leader or as a guru or as somebody who wants to spiritually develop people. And then really in a way just loses, everyone loses contact with reality.
What's it like writing a screenplay as compared to the novel? When you wrote Heat and Dust, for example, here's a rather complex book. That was the one that won the Booker Prize, didn't it?
Yes.
That's a rather complex book. And I was, when I saw the film, it's a very complex film, mm-hmm. too, and it takes a while to assimilate it. But yet the book has to be more complex on many, many different levels, and to try to work this out in terms of a screenplay must be enormously difficult. Or is it not?
I don't know.
Maybe it's easy.
Well, of course, a book is much more difficult than a screenplay anyway, that's for sure. I mean, it's much more difficult to write a book than it is to write a screenplay, especially an adapted screenplay, which is more a sort of technical. But the film, you're really more concerned with technical problems of setting up scenes, of making a story move, of giving proper dialogue to the actors, giving the sort of scenes that to the director that he's good at, that he can really do. So it's, but with the book, because you do everything yourself.
Well, the movie did make certain demands because it's a story told on two levels, and with flashbacks within flashbacks. And I noticed that Merchant Ivory, they just cut, you know, and they left it up to the viewer to assimilate. And at first, that was a little confusing at first. After a while, you began to see exactly what they were doing, and everything gelled. But when they do a film and you write the screenplay, are you ordered off the set, or are you there to advise?
I'm not
or
there.
How's it
oh,
work?
No, I'm not on the set at all. No. They don't have to order me off. I don't come anywhere near them. Well, I pay a courtesy visit once, maybe, but no. I mean, I hand over the screenplay, and if difficulties arise, they call me, and usually it's not necessary. Usually we only see the difficulties when we are through. And they just shoot it, and the actor and the director get together, and the cameraman, of course, and all the technicians, and they make it, and I go away and do something completely different, try to forget that they're doing this. But then then I see, you know, their rushes, and then they assemble it into a rough cut, and then I go and have a look at the rough cut, and then we start chopping it around, and, you know, to make the story work, and correct whatever weakness we find, and we always do find quite a bit.
Well, if you work on that level, if you see the rough cuts and the rushes and so forth, the movie probably doesn't come as a surprise to you when the final form appears on the screen.
No.
I wonder what that would be like to see your work as you had envisioned it on paper all of a sudden transferred to the screen.
That doesn't happen to me because I do see as I go along.
Yeah.
But I am used to that from the very first film, which was also from a book of mine called The Householder. As I went to see the rushes, and I realized at once that, well, I'd better forget my book because this is something completely different and the characters are completely different. They're no longer my vision at all. So I knew, like, you know, from day one that that whatever I had written is going to be transformed, transcended, hopefully. It has to be.
You're reconciled to that fact.
Oh, absolutely.
And it doesn't bother you?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, if it didn't happen, that would bother me, I think, because that would mean that it would just be something flattened on the page. But after all, the actor's personality have to enter into it. The director's style personality has to enter into it to make it a film. A film is not just a writer's medium. It isn't a writer's medium at all, really.
How did you enter in this partnership with the Merchant and Ivory?
Well, they bought that book, The Householder, and they said, why did you write the screenplay? Well, I'd never written a screenplay, but they'd never made a film either. So we said, oh, all right, we'll do it. So we did it. And then Ismail, the producer, went out and sold it. And with the money, we straight away made another film, one that James Ivory wanted to make about traveling actors in India.
That was Shakespeare-wala. I have taped that. I haven't seen it. I wanted to watch it last night before I interviewed you today because I taped it. It was on a cable channel some time ago, but I didn't get home until late last night, and I couldn't do it. So I'm very anxious to see how that one... That was the second film.
That was the second, yeah. That was 1964, yeah. That's a long time ago.
You also did the adaptation of the Forrester book, right? The Room with a View?
I did Room with a View, yeah, also. Two Forrester books I've done.
What was the other one?
Howard's End.
You were just nominated for an Academy Award for that, weren't you?
Yeah. Howard's End and Room with a View, and two Henry James. We did The Europeans and The Bostonians.
Are you going out to the Oscars?
Well, I'll see how I feel. I mean, if I'm well enough, I'll go. But at the moment, we're all down with the flu.
What was it like winning the the Booker Prize? Were you there when they announced the
award? Yes, I did. But at that time, they used to tell you beforehand. So I was in India, and they said, "Well, you know, this is very secret, but you have won the Booker Prize." So then I said, okay, then I'll go to England. But if it is as it is nowadays, they only tell you at the last moment, no, then I wouldn't go.
I read this hilarious article about the Booker Prizes. I think it was in Vanity Fair, maybe Vogue, I can't remember, just in the last couple of months. And it's almost like a circus with the bookies taking odds.
Yeah, it's ludicrous. Oh, but it wasn't like that at all at that time.
People storming out, getting angry.
This is the ridiculous thing. I mean, you can do that with actor. Okay, the Academy Awards, all right, the cameras are on you, and, these are actors. They're supposed to know what to do. If they feel disappointed, they don't show it. But an author will burst into tears. We are not, trained to hide our feelings. On the contrary.
I'm not sure how you judge the best book in any event. I mean, books are so different, so personal. They're almost like...
It's a lottery. I mean, it's just luck.
But a book is almost like a fingerprint. Yeah. You know, a fingerprint is a unique mark that you will make on a piece of paper or on a side of a glass or something like that. But isn't the way one writes almost the same thing? And the complexity of that work or the lack of it is something else. But everything is so different, and to be able to say, well, this fingerprint is better than the other fingerprints.
I know.
Does that make sense at all?
Of course not. Not at all. So whatever prize one wins, I mean, one is happy, but could so easily have gone the other way. It's just like drawing a lottery ticket.
Well, we're just about out of time, but I wanted to ask you what is in your future in literary terms, after you collect the Oscar for Howard's End.
Oh, I got a 20% chance. You mean with films or books?
Well, looking ahead at the future a little bit, what sort of thing?
Well, I'm writing another novel. This one, actually, I wrote, and I'll do novels. I mean, I used to publish them like once a year, once every 2 years, but now I write a novel and then I put it away for a time, then I take it out again, and this goes on for 2 or 3 years. So I'm now on another novel with that process of writing, putting away, taking out. Because in between I write all these screenplays. We've just done the screenplay. We've already shot the film of Remains of the Day, you know, that Ishiguro book about the English butler.
Yes, I interviewed him when I first got the book a couple of years ago. I looked at it and I said, this book's not going to interest me. And I gave it away. I gave the book away. And then I began reading about it. And finally I got a paperback copy of it. And I could not put it down. I mean, you're talking about a book that is so benign. when you think about it. I mean, it's a butler whose master, of course, is a Nazi or a pro-Nazi. Did you read the book?
Of course, you did the screenplay.
You just said that. Here is such a benign life that this butler holds, and I swear that I just could not put that book down. And I finally arranged to interview him, but I was just kicking myself the first time around that I didn't have the wisdom to see that book for what it was. He says he's written a second one too, that is also very good. I can't remember the title.
What was it? I haven't read it. I think this was his third book, actually. Anyway,
It may be.
And I think the one before that was actually set in Japan, although he's as English.
It was indeed set in Japan, yeah. And he went to school. Let's see, as I recall, he was born in Japan, but his father was a scientist of some sort and moved to England, where he went to school. And in fact, his Japanese is not very good, and he would only go back to visit.
Yeah, he's absolutely English. And I know people often ask, how could a Japanese know all that? But he's been there since he was six. He really doesn't know anything else.
So your new book, you're using New York themes. Is that going to be set here?
Again, no book of mine hasn't got a bit of India, including this one, of course. I mean, I've never written a book that doesn't have some of India in it. So this would be like my fourth book, not actually set in India or about India, which all the others are. But, of course, it does have big chunks of India and Indian characters and some Indian settings. And
you know, it's interesting that you say that you will put a book away, you'll write the draft or so and put it away. Yeah, because I was reading a biography of Hemingway not too long ago, and he did that because he said that he needed to get perspective a little bit and look at it. He could get so close to it, he couldn't. The words just seemed to blend in a way that he couldn't make judgments. And so he would put a book away for 7 months, 8 months, 9 months, and then get it out and look at it again.
Yeah, that's what I do now. I didn't do it when I was young. When you're young, you're like a savage, I think. You write and, you know, and you don't think anything of it. And you write and you publish, and then you publish some more and you write some more. And you never look back and you never. I mean, it's like a sort of physical, it's like an instinctual thing almost. It's like youth, you know. You can do all those things and never give it a second thought. But then you get older, well, I don't know. You slow up for one thing.
Well, you say slow up, but and you're certainly a veteran writer now, but I would imagine that you have learned techniques and ways of dealing with your subject that you probably couldn't have dealt with when you first started.
No.
Is it easier now?
No.
No.
On the contrary, no. You never learn. You never learn. No. Every time it's the new problems, and every time you think, oh, God, what am I doing? How can I do this? I'll never be able to do this. And every time it's difficult. Each book has its own difficulty, and you've never solved it. Never.
Do you regiment your life in such a way that you allocate a certain period of the day where you actually work on the book?
Oh, yeah.
Or do you work in spurts like some people?
No. I do every day. I mean, I write a certain number of hours every day.
Well, I'm certainly a gifted writer, Ruth Brower Chabala, and Poet and Dancer is a beautiful novel. Thank you very, very much for talking to me.
Thank you.